You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body, and I'm in Boston at one of the year's most important HIV research meetings. It's the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, and it's known as CROI. I'm here with Dr. Joel Gallant, who has been treating people with HIV since the beginning of the pandemic. He's also a leading HIV researcher and a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Welcome, Dr. Gallant. I wonder if you could share with our listeners your take on the most interesting research presented at CROI.
Well, I'm going to have to speak from my own perspective of being interested in treatment. There was a lot of stuff about prevention that we can talk about, too. You know, I'm focused more on treatment, and one of the most important clinical trials was the CASEL study that was the first head-to-head comparison of Kaletra with boosted Reataz, that is, Reataz given with Norvir. We've been using a lot of boosted Reataz over the years, but without really any big study really demonstrating that it was as effective. And so we finally had that study, and it really looks like it's fine. Both drugs did very well, but there were some advantages of Reataz, specifically in terms of side effects like diarrhea, nausea, and a little bit less effect on cholesterol and triglycerides. So, you know, the data are really telling us that all these boosted PIs work great, and you don't pick one because it's stronger. You pick it because maybe you like the side effects better, or it has fewer pills or different doses. They all seem to work very well.
I think people in the audience may not understand is sometimes drugs are not approved for first-line use, but they're used anyway, and that's very common. A lot of drugs are not used for what it's approved for.
In the U.S., that's true, because once a drug is approved, we can use it off-label, if you will. We don't have to use it for the approved indication. In some countries, they do, and so they are very much restricted by the local country's approval mechanism. But for us, we've been able to use boosted Reataz, and in fact, it's been a preferred regimen in the guidelines, even though it hasn't had that FDA indication.
Were there any other first-line therapies that were looked at?
Well, there was the HEAT study, which was the first head-to-head comparison of Truvada with Epsicom. These are both nucleoside backbones, and they were combined with Kaletra. And, you know, there's been a lot of debate over which of these is better. Bottom line is they both look fine, both look great, did a great job. There was no difference in terms of the effectiveness of either one. And in terms of side effects, you know, the things you would expect would be hypersensitivity with the Epsicom and kidney issues with the Truvada, but really didn't see much of that. They weren't doing HLA-B5701 screening the way we would do now, so they did have, obviously, a little more hypersensitivity in the Epsicom arm. There wasn't much in the way of kidney problems with the Truvada. I mean, a little bit, but, you know, less than 1%. So, and a little bit better cholesterol and triglyceride profile with Truvada than Epsicom. But for the most part, you know, they both look good. And the resistance differences that were seen really didn't seem to be very important.
Did you have a new perspective on that because of the Biogen studies from Europe?
Well, it was interesting because just, a week or two ago, the DHHS guidelines in the U.S. changed, recommending that Epsicom and Truvada are now the preferred nucleoside backbones, and Combivir has been demoted to alternative. Everybody thought that made perfect sense. The European guidelines had just made that change as well. And then along came the HEAT study that I just mentioned, showing that those are both good combinations, so everybody's happy. And then this DAD study comes along. Now, the DAD is a big observational cohort study that's really been doing a lot of work on looking at cardiovascular complications of treatment and, you know, things like myocardial infarction or heart attack and lipid changes and things like that. So they set out to look at the nucleoside component of therapy to see if that made a difference. And their suspicion, their hypothesis was that people who were taking thymidine analogs like AZT and D4T would be at higher risk for heart attack because those drugs increase cholesterol. And what they found was that wasn't the case, that in fact, it was abacavir that increased the risk, and to a lesser degree, DDI, abacavir being Zyogen and a component of Epsicom. They found what they called a 90% increase in risk, which sounds horrible, but keep in mind that the numbers of heart attacks were very, very low. So you're talking about a 90% increase over a very low number. Nobody has any idea how abacavir would do this if it does. And keep in mind that this is an observational study. I mean, in other words, people weren't randomized to take abacavir. They just were looking at whatever people happened to be taking. So there's a lot of room for what we call selection bias. So for example, if somebody was on a protease inhibitor and their cholesterol went up and they developed coronary artery disease, and then the doctor said, oh, I got to get them off this protease inhibitor to protect their heart, switched them to Zyogen, then they had a heart attack. You know, maybe it was the protease inhibitor's fault, not the Zyogen. It just happened to be that people were more likely to be on Zyogen if they had had these problems. So that's an example of selection bias. The investigators tried to control for that as best they could with various, you know, statistical methods, but you can never completely eliminate that bias. So I don't think we know right now whether this is a real risk of Zyogen Epsicom or not. We need to keep an open mind. We need to look at this further and see whether it is. It's certainly not a reason for people to panic and rush out and stop or change their therapy at this point. I mean, your risk, if there is a risk of a heart attack from this drug, it's small in comparison with the risk of smoking or sitting on the couch eating potato chips, you know. So you have to be realistic and put this all in perspective.
So if you had a patient who was worried about this and has heart disease, would you take them off of Zyogen?
Tenofovir or Viriad or the combination of Truvada is certainly also a great combination. If somebody was really worried about it, I'd be happy to switch them to Truvada, provided that there weren't kidney issues. So if somebody has problems with their kidneys, then they're definitely better off on Zyogen or Epsicom. But if there aren't any kidney issues, then you could certainly use Truvada instead of Epsicom, and that, there would be no problem there. But I doubt that I'm going to recommend that to my patients. I would certainly listen to my patients if they were concerned about the issue.
You're not going to be proactive?
Well, I have to say, most of the most common nucleoside regimen that I use in practice is Truvada, mm-hmm. Because it doesn't require the testing of HLA-B5701, and it has excellent data. So if I have a patient on Epsicom, it's usually for a good reason. It usually is because for whatever reason they can't take Truvada. Maybe they have kidney issues or something like that. So most of the people I've got on Epsicom probably need to be on Epsicom. Now, that may not be true for all physicians. Some are much more commonly using Epsicom. And I don't know whether this single study should change their practice or not. It's hard to say. I think, again, it's an observational study, which is its weakness. On the other hand, it's a very powerful observational study with huge numbers of patients and has produced some very good studies from this same cohort in the past. So we have to look at this, but I think the jury's still out on whether this is a real risk or not.
So I guess we should warn patients that nobody should run out and stop taking their drug because they're worried of this. They should discuss this with their physician.
The risk of stopping your drug is far greater than any risk of heart problems could ever be. And again, remember, this was a huge study. Thousands of patients. They didn't see very many heart attacks. It's just that they saw more with abacavir.
Right, 33,000 patients.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So we're talking about a very small number of events. And so, the relative risk may have been there, but the absolute risk is very low.
Okay, and related to, I guess, heart disease, were there a bunch of presentations at the conference about, I guess, the risk of heart disease in older patients or in all patients? Could you comment on that?
You know, obviously our patients are getting older, and we hope they'll keep getting older. And so they're already at higher risk for heart disease just by aging, but there's always been, you know, evidence that HIV itself can increase the risk of heart disease. Some of our treatment can increase the risk of heart disease if it affects cholesterol. And there was the interesting findings from the SMART study. Remember, the SMART study was the one where they randomized people to either continue therapy or to stop and then restart when their CD4 dropped. And one of the early observations from the SMART study was that people who stopped therapy were more likely to have heart attacks. Everybody thought, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would it should be the other way around? Well, people on therapy should have more heart attacks because of the cholesterol changes, but it wasn't that way. And so people have been looking for a reason. Why would stopping therapy increase the risk of heart attacks? And one thought was that maybe when your viral load goes up, you know, you develop inflammation or immune activation that could cause coronary plaques to form. So one of the presentations today was looking at a lab test called D-dimer, which is a test that's used to sort of measure how easy it is for your blood to form clots. And having a high D-dimer level is associated with clotting more easily. And that's not a good thing, because clots in your coronary arteries are what cause myocardial infarction. And what they found was that in the SMART study, when you stopped therapy, your D-dimer levels went way up. And the more your viral load went up, the higher the D-dimer level went up. And so, you know, this suggests that what's happening is that HIV drugs are keeping this, as they keep your viral load suppressed, they're also keeping this D-dimer down. They're making it harder for you to form these bad clots. And then when you stop therapy, that clotting risk returns. This raises the whole question of, you know, it presumably isn't just stopping therapy that increases your D-dimer, but probably also not being on therapy at all. And we've long had data that people who are untreated with HIV are more likely to develop clots in their veins, and certainly, you know, people with dialysis catheters are more likely to clot those things off. And this may have to do with this easier clotting in untreated HIV, and it raises this whole question of when should you start therapy? Should we be starting earlier because of these issues? It hasn't been answered yet, but it's an intriguing concept.
So wouldn't this be compounded if you already have a genetic risk for heart disease?
Yeah, possibly. There's a number of risk factors for heart disease, some of which you have no control over, like your genes and your sex. Others you do have control over, like smoking and high blood pressure and diabetes and high cholesterol. And so if you have a strong family history of heart disease, or if you have some of these other risk factors for heart disease that you haven't modified, you know, then having untreated HIV could be another risk factor that increases your risk.
Wow. So what should a 22-year-old recently diagnosed with HIV, you know, feel about these kind of numbers and worries? I mean, are they the population that's being discussed, or is it really just the older population of HIV-infected people?
Well, a 22-year-old is much less likely to get into this kind of difficulty, because presumably they have far fewer risk factors for these issues. And I think we're only beginning to talk about this now because our population is aging and they're getting into the age where these things can happen. But I think that for people of any age, there is evidence that it's better to have treated HIV than untreated HIV. It's better to have an undetectable viral load than a detectable viral load. We haven't yet gotten to the point where we're going to say everybody should be treated no matter what. But, you know, theoretically, that could be true. And right now, we sort of compromise, and we say that if your T cells are below 350, then you should be treated. But I don't think there's a limit, an upper limit. I think you could argue that everybody's better off having a suppressed viral load.
And what about cancer and HIV? Were there any presentations of interest?
I'm sure there probably were. I didn't, unfortunately, get to see them. But the focus is now moving away from the so-called AIDS cancers like Kaposi's sarcoma and lymphoma, and moving to looking at the sort of non-HIV-associated cancers. And we're finding that some of them, in fact, are HIV-associated, that if you have a low CD4 or a high viral load, you're more likely to get not just lymphoma and KS, but some of these other cancers. And so, again, another reason why you want to be treated for HIV rather than letting your CD4 get low.
Okay, so hepatitis C, did you follow anything there? I know they're seeing a lot more sexual transmissions of hepatitis C in people with HIV.
Yeah, the hepatitis C stuff always goes on in parallel with the HIV stuff, so I never get to go to that. Unfortunately, I work with so many hep C experts that I can just ask them when I have a question. You know, we're all waiting for these newer, better drugs for hepatitis C and hoping that they're coming along. We are seeing sexual transmission. It's not common. And it appears to be, you know, associated with, you know, rougher sex and sex that may involve blood contact. But it also appears that if you are acutely infected with hepatitis C, you have a much better chance of being cured if you get treated right away than if you wait and let it turn into chronic hepatitis C. So people and clinicians need to be aware of this. If you have people whose liver tests are going up for no good reason, make sure that you test for that using PCR testing to make that diagnosis so you can get people on treatment right away.
It's been an odd conference because there's not a lot of new drugs being discussed. I think there's just one CCR5 inhibitor being discussed, because compared to all the other conferences, this is kind of subdued when it comes to new options.
Yeah, we're in kind of a lull now after the veritable avalanche of new drugs from last year. We had so many new ones that came out up till Intellis was just approved in the last couple of weeks. And I don't think we're going to see a lot of new approvals anytime soon. And the drugs that we have coming, while they have their advantages, aren't necessarily drugs that will offer something to people who have failed the current ones. So, for example, elvitegravir, the new Gilead integrase inhibitor, has cross-resistance with Isentress. by Crivaroc, which is the next CCR5 inhibitor. It's not going to work if you've failed Maraviroc or Celcentri because you'll have X4 virus or dual mixed tropic virus. You won't respond to it. So, you know, there may be a while, and that's why I think it's going to be so important that we use these drugs well, because if we start seeing the emergence of resistance to integrase inhibitors, and, you know, we're not going to have a lot of options to fall back to.
Were there any new targets being looked at this conference? I don't know if you followed anything. Or
I tend to avoid the very early preclinical stuff because so many of those drugs never make it into clinical trials, and I just sort of focus on the drugs that are in clinical stages of testing. But you know, people are looking at new types of entry inhibitors, including small molecule entry inhibitors that could be taken orally. And there's still some hope. There's hope for this maturation inhibitor, bevirimat, things like that.
There was one study that somebody told me about. I didn't get to see, but it was about using a drug intravenously once a month or something?
Yeah, there's been several. There's the Tanox drug, which has been looked at, and that's usually every 1 to 2 weeks. And then there's a Tibotec NNRTI that they're hoping could be given once a month by infusion or injection. So that, you know, that would be very exciting and could have implications for things like pre-exposure prophylaxis as well.
Right. So there's some excitement. Anything else that we didn't cover?
Well, the big downer at this meeting is the prevention news. You know, as exciting as treatment news is, the prevention news just continues to be depressing. You know, we had the failure of the vaccine this year. We had circumcision looks good in preventing HIV in men, but it doesn't seem to be helping the female partners in Africa when men get circumcised. And there was the failure of the first vaginal microbicide recently. And now at this meeting, we heard that treating people with acyclovir doesn't help to prevent
transmission. Right, and that's the herpes drug.
Yeah.
So there was hope that if you took the herpes drug, because there were some suppression.
It's not that these drugs directly suppress HIV, but first of all, they keep you from having ulcers, you know, genital ulcers, which are a great way for HIV to get in. And we also know that having herpes kind of activates your HIV replication. So the hope was that by using that kind of a drug, you would decrease spread, but it didn't seem to work. So the real hope now is in specific microbicides, microbicides that contain active anti-HIV drugs, and PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis, where you actually give drugs to people who are negative and try to keep them from getting infected. Uh-huh. And of course, condoms are still a good idea too.
And I think in the HIV testing arena of the poster session, there seems to be a decreasing use of condoms and an increase in unprotected sex among at least men who have sex with men.
Yeah, it's concerning. I think people have lost their fear of HIV. And of course, it isn't the same disease it was 20 years ago, and it's not as scary. But still, who wants to have a chronic disease? I still think preventing it is better than treating it. And I think, you know, I think we need to still focus on that. And you know, there's a lot of talk now at the CDC of directing the message of prevention towards people who are positive rather than negative. You know, directing it at people who are negative has not worked very well. And people who are negative do incredibly dumb things. And so I think we need to focus on people who are positive and get that message that, you know, the disease stops with me. I used to hear that a lot in the 80s and the early 90s. People would come in and they said, this stops with me. I'm not spreading it to anybody. I don't hear that so much anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear that again.
Do you think methamphenamine is part of that story?
You couldn't design a better drug for spreading this epidemic than crystal meth. You know, a drug that enhances sex, enhances your ability to have lots of sex, and completely takes away all judgment and inhibitions. I mean, it's just made for this. And I'm seeing a lot of HIV transmission, including transmission of resistant virus that's directly linked to crystal meth.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I guess to wrap up, there might be news coming out of the conference about cancer or about heart disease, but most patients really don't have to worry. Could we put that in perspective for people?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, all of these things are so tiny and minuscule in comparison with the risk of not treating your HIV, you know. And it's a luxury that we can focus on things like heart attacks. When you think back to, you know, before 1996, we would have loved to be talking about your risk of future heart attack because people were dying every day. And so it's great that we can now be focused on these long-term complications and trying to prevent them. At the same time, you know, I think despite these occasional glitches and pieces of bad news, you know, our drugs are getting safer and safer and easier to take. And, you know, frankly, when I look at my patient population of, say, 250 to 300 people, you know, of course, I have a few people who are dealing with a lot of these issues, but most of them are not. They're doing great. and they're working and feeling good, and they frankly don't have to spend much time thinking about their HIV when they take their pills once a day. So, you know, I think things have really improved.
Right, and isn't it true, I heard a statistic from somebody that one of the biggest lifestyle changes somebody can make to reduce their risk of heart disease is to stop smoking, because
absolutely.
Such a great percentage of people with HIV smoke.
Yeah, so, smoking dwarfs all other risk factors. You know, I mean, you know, when you think about protease inhibitors increasing your cholesterol, that the risk that that causes is minuscule compared to the risk of smoking. And the day you stop smoking, you know, you lower your risk significantly for heart disease. So if I have a patient who's smoking and then worried about their protease inhibitor, you know, we have to have some kind of a common sense talk, because that is such a big risk for heart disease, not to mention, you know, stroke and lung disease and cancer and all sorts of other problems you don't want to have.
Right. So this hopefully puts in perspective. Maybe we can do a big graph where we show smoking this huge, you know, thing, and actually the risks from some of these drugs much less.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, okay, so a pretty good conference, you would say.
Yeah, I would say it's a pretty good conference, and hopefully, you know, we'll have maybe more exciting stuff at future conferences, and hopefully better news on the prevention front, but in terms of treatment, things are going very well.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.